Actually, it's customary that appellant is over here. That isn't the way they situated themselves the last time, and I guess we have bigger fish to fry than who sits where, but in any event, that's the custom. Don't worry about it. That's appellant and respondent is kind of customary.
Glad you clarified that.
Thank you, yes.
You feel better now.
I was very unsettled.
The next matter on the calendar, and take your time getting situated, the next matter on the calendar is State versus Abrahamson. My name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding today. With me are Chief Judge Cleary and Judge Larkin. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name so that we have that for the recording. And the podium is adjustable. There's a little toggle switch down there if you want to adjust it up and down, get yourself comfortable, make sure it's to the right height. Appellant, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Rod Cheat. I represent the appellant in this matter, Brian Abrahamson. And the thrust of the major issue, I think, in the case is whether or not these field sobriety tests, specifically the preliminary breath tests, are a legal mandate of sorts such that it made the police officer's statement to Mr. Abrahamson legally correct. Our position, of course, is that field sobriety testing is optional. We had a case in this court, a published decision this year, again stating that, in fact, drivers can and do refuse field sobriety tests, including PBTs. And so that's just following the logic in the Vondrachek case. But that case was Otto versus Commissioner of Public Safety, 924 Northwest 2nd, 658. Trial court also ruled to that effect, hereby stating that the subject is able to decline performing the requested tests.
Let's say that's true. How do you get the relief you're seeking? So let's say a person has a right to refuse a PBT,
Lee?
And the police told him he did not.
Thank you.
What's the legal theory that gets you to suppression?
I think it could be threefold. It could be due process, which is argued. It could be the Fourth Amendment. But I don't think we have to get to the Fourth Amendment. We might have to get to due process.
So what's the due process theory?
The theory is that it's a misleading statement of the law. Under McDonald, under Raley.
The question I have about that theory is Raley and McDonald involve misleading statements regarding criminal liability. The decision would or wouldn't subject someone to criminal liability. We don't have that situation here. Do you have any case law that indicates the due process, you know, the government can't mislead people as to their obligations, applies in a context other than inaccurate statements regarding potential criminal liability?
You know, as McDonald said in 1991, that, you know, it followed Raley's logic, right? Misstatements of law, active misleading.
But isn't what happened in Raley, and I might be wrong, correct me if so, that the government told the person, it's okay to testify, you won't be subjecting yourself to criminal liability. And in fact, they were subjecting themselves to criminal liability.
That's correct. I mean, I think it also applies here in this case, obviously different factual scenario. But I think our case law in Minnesota makes clear that, in fact, this is not limited to, for example, implied consent or DWI testing. That's actually what cases citing McDonald have said after McDonald, right? And so one of those cases was not cited in our brief, unfortunately, but Slowinski, 450 Northwest 2nd, 107. The police didn't misstate the law in securing a confession, right? So it doesn't really go to the issue of criminal liability. It goes to the issue of whether or not a correct statement of the law was made in order to secure that confession. A very similar case is Miller, 316 Northwest 2nd, 23. Again, no false statements in securing the confession. Even a better case, perhaps, is Witten, which was a case where the discharge papers from probation had accidentally stated that the defendant was restored to all civil rights, including firearm privileges. And of course, Witten cited to McDonald and indicated that, look, due process prohibits state representatives from misleading individuals as to their legal obligations. And that was it. And cited to some of the former case law, both federal and state, as I recall. And so, just
so
like
in the
I'm sorry?
In the probation case, a situation where the government said you're restored to your rights, you can possess a gun, and then he was charged for possessing a gun after the government told him he could do so.
Right.
That seems a lot like the first case, the federal case. You were given information that was incorrect, and as a result, you were charged with a crime.
And even data master testing then perhaps is a better example right now, where we have the sort of the three-prong test. Did you take the test? Was there prejudicial reliance, and was it an inaccurate statement? Doesn't necessarily go to, and this is the due process, of course, doesn't necessarily go to criminal liability. It goes to whether or not the test was admissible based on consent. So I think it's criminal liability cases as well as simply coercion or non-consensual types of situations where evidence is sort of compelled.
When you mentioned some confession cases, and in that context, we looked at whether or not the confession was compelled or coerced. I thought those cases sort of said, you know, I don't like this, but the police can lie to a suspect in obtaining a confession, and that's okay.
Right.
How is this different than that line of thinking?
Exactly. And in some countries, we don't allow police to misstate the facts. But here we do. But we don't allow police to misstate the law. And so if, in fact, field sobriety testing is optional and it's not a legal mandate, then that is a misstatement of law, which occurred in this case. So really the only legal mandate for a preliminary breath test that I could see would be search incident to arrest at the time of the arrest. I'm not sure how that would procedurally work. You're gonna force a preliminary breath test out on the roadway. So I guess logistically, I'm not sure how we would do that. But it's clear that that wasn't the kind of thing that took place here. The misstatements occurred long before the arrest, and so we have a due process issue. We potentially have a Fourth Amendment issue as well, but I don't think the court would necessarily need to get into that simply because our case law is that you can refuse. You're not compelled to perform field sobriety tests. So the fact the trial court kind of did that, right? Didn't really get into the Fourth Amendment, whether it was a search, wasn't a search. It just sort of analyzed the Brooks factors. And certainly that didn't come out of left field completely. It's a good case to determine whether or not someone's consented. But we don't need to sort of answer the Fourth Amendment question.
So you're going on a Fourth Amendment theory regarding the PBT. So are you trying to apply the three-step McDonald test? Is that the argument?
I think the three-part test is more along the lines of Morehouse and Johnson, which came out more recently. But I think we could apply that to this scenario. And again, as McDonald said, this is not confined to DWI testing, implied consent testing. But that's where we are here. So we can't say, well, you know, Morehouse mentioned something about advisory. We don't have an advisory here. Due process covers a wide variety of legal issues, as I think we sort of talked about. And so so our position is that the trial court did err with regard to those consent factors that it discussed under Brooks. There's seven of those factors, and it appears to me that
Counsel, what's the relevance of the fact that he refused it three times and didn't agree until after he was arrested?
Well, that would go into the Brooks factors. For example, one of the factors in Brooks was, you know, was the person already arrested by the time that
right. So it looks like it's lacking coercion at that point. You're already arrested, right?
If you're arrested first and then PBT, then that actually promotes a finding of coercion under Brooks. And so that's what we're arguing here, because the police officer said, you could kind of see the police officer in the video, well, you're under arrest. And then he's waiting for something as if he thinks maybe he's going to take the test now. And that was sort of the final straw there. But that's one of the factors, of course, in Brooks. The only factor I would give to the state is there's no direct penalty for refusing a preliminary breath test. But the rest of the factors here, as I see them, they all go to Mr. Abramson.
Well, there's kind of an indirect penalty for refusing, because what happens is you get arrested.
Correct. And the PBT becomes admissible against you pursuant to statute if you're a B card holder. And so that's relevant.
Right. But I mean, when you're talking about the totality of the circumstances out there, does an officer have probable cause to arrest? It is true that Vonderchuk says you don't have a penalty, it can't be compelled. At the same time, what actually happens is if you refuse the PBT, the officer is more likely to arrest you.
Correct. And I think the implied consent statute still states that they have to plus probable cause.
Right.
But in practice, yeah, I think there's a presumption that if you're not taking the test, you know, you must be under the influence.
And the manner in which you refuse, I mean, if you're belligerent and what have you, that all goes into the totality and you end up getting arrested.
And we see a very cooperative person here, I think, trying to exercise what he believed to be his legal rights until that was sort of overborne.
So you're making two separate arguments as to the PBT. One is that there was a due process violation, it should be suppressed on that ground. The other is there was a Fourth Amendment violation, it was coerced consent, it should be suppressed on that ground. But you don't need a warrant to do a PBT.
No, you would need...
But you're still saying you'd need consent.
I think you need consent. Now,
I'm just wondering how you apply a consent exception, which is developed and applied in the context of an exception to a warrant requirement, to a reasonable articulable suspicion requirement.
Right. You know, the statute talks about the reasonable suspicion. This goes all the way back to Vivering and Jankowski, I think early 80s, right, where we need reasonable suspicion to request. They didn't say requirement there. They said to request it. So that's sort of an initial burden you have to get to. You have to have reasonable suspicion of, and the statute actually says DWI. It doesn't say B card. It
could. Are you arguing there wasn't reasonable suspicion justifying a PBT?
Well, at the point, we didn't argue it. No, so I can't argue that now. We're just arguing for suppression of the PBT on those three grounds, due process, Fourth Amendment, and then without regard to the Constitution. Do you have a right just to refuse field sobriety as a matter of case, you know, precedent, I guess, industry practice to some extent? And so we did cite a case in our brief in Kansas that basically didn't go through the Brooks consent factors, and this is maybe why. You know, to me, when I argued originally to the trial court, you know, what is, you know, how do you
analyze? I'm not understanding why you go through the Brooks factors when Brooks applies to Fourth Amendment analysis concerning an exception to the warrant requirement, and we don't have a warrant requirement.
Right. Well, the trial court did that, and I think it's reasonable that the court did that. Do we have to resort to the Brooks factors? No, I would just say it's coercion under, for example, the case in Kansas, State v. Edgard. You can't tell someone they don't have any right to refuse a PBT.
But they have a different statute, right? Doesn't that statute in Kansas require that the person be told they have a right to refuse, but they don't have to take the test?
Right. But again, here we have somebody who is going well beyond that, telling them they don't have the right to refuse. We know that you do have the right to refuse a PBT. It's all over our case law.
And your position is even if he had refused, there was still probable cause would have been lacking for the subsequent arrest and breath test?
That's what we argued in the trial court. I don't think there was a specific ruling by the trial court on probable cause. I think it said the court didn't need to reach that based on its ruling that the PBT was admissible. Of course, we would have liked the court to have gone further and decided the issue of probable cause.
If there was probable cause without the PBT and HDN, does this matter?
No, but I mean, well, I suppose we'd have to, the state argues we send this back to the trial court to decide that issue. There's no case that basically says that, you know, good driving, good balance and everything, good parking, good reaction to instructions, things like that. That would be probable cause for DWI because we had an odor at glassy eyes. I don't, whether this court needs to send that.
Speeding, odor, glassy eyes. Admission of drinking, inconsistent statements regarding drinking. I think the case law recognizes that raises a concern.
Might raise a concern, but we sort of have to have that affirmative evidence, and none of it bears itself out in the video. We don't know whether the officer would have made the arrest absent the gaze and stagmus test, for example.
Existence of probable cause is a legal determination. It's not based on the officer's subjective view of the circumstances. It's an objective test. So I'm just wondering if, you know, you take out the gaze test, you take out the PBT, and given the circumstances, there was still probable cause for arrest and a request for breath test, do the arguments about the legality of the PBT matter?
No, I don't suppose that they would, but I don't find absent the gaze and stagmus test PBT or either one of them. I don't see an honest and strong suspicion here of DWI offense. Perhaps there's room for disagreement there, but I think that's clear. I don't see any cases that would go quite that far. I cited a couple unpublished ones that was sort of along the same lines, where probable cause was not found. So I think we can sort of carry these doctrines that we brought up, due process, Fourth Amendment, or really just sort of the history of field sobriety testing and case law. We can bring them into the PBT context. That's kind of what the Kansas, what we see in the Kansas case, where there's not a lot of reference to particular factors. But again, these factors, obviously the biggest ones, and another reason we know that you can refuse a PBT, they're in Vondracek when they looked at those seven factors, right? Whether a driver retains the right to refuse to submit to the testing is a question, in question is a consideration. Whether you've told someone they've got, you know, no right, whether the driver had an opportunity to consult with a lawyer, an arrest before the claim consent makes it less likely that the consent was voluntary. Here we had the trial court split some hairs there in suggesting that, well, he wasn't quite placed under arrest yet. He was told he was under arrest, and the defendant's testimony was accurate. He said, I was being told I was being under arrest, and then that's when I agreed to take the PBT. But the word agreement shouldn't be blown up. This is a case where it's submission to authority, much like Bumper versus North Carolina. That's the case where the police said, look, we got a search warrant, Mrs. Leith, right? Grandma, owner of the home. And she said, well, go ahead and search. It happened pretty quickly, right? But it's the misstatement, right, that they didn't have a search warrant or that somehow later that wasn't a valid grounds for the search. So that can happen pretty quickly, right? But when something like that happens, when you submit to the authority, the United States Supreme Court calls that instinct with coercion in Bumper, and that's what we have here, as seen in the Edgar case that we cite. As far as the due process issue on the PBT, again, we don't have to use the Morehouse framework. We could simply, I think, apply McDonald and some of these other cases that we talk about.
What do you mean by the Morehouse framework as distinguished from McDonald?
Well, McDonald basically was, you know, misstatement of law, and was it actively misleading? I think McDonald is still good law, but we don't see the active misleading part. What we see is you need to take a test, mm-hmm. you need to show that you prejudicially relied on it, and that there was a misstatement of law. And so I felt
that's
that
from Morehouse, right?
Morehouse, and
okay,
right. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you want to use that time. Respondent?
May it please the court, Mr. Chita. I'm Cassandra Wolfgram, and I represent the state of Minnesota, city of West St. Paul. We are here today on a DWI charge from October 2017, where Mr. Abrahamson was found guilty of driving while impaired in violation of a restricted driver's license. I'm going to begin by talking about one of Judge Larkin's questions, and that was about probable cause. If we took out the horizontal gaze nystagmus test and the preliminary breath test, would there still be probable cause? And the answer is yes. Minnesota law is very clear that for a DWI, you need one objective criteria of intoxication. In this case, excluding the horizontal gaze nystagmus test and the preliminary breath test, Trooper Lanois observed that Mr. Abrahamson was speeding approximately 17 miles over the speed limit. He had glassy, watery, and bloodshot eyes. And he observed an odor of alcohol coming from the vehicle. This is sufficient for probable cause under the Minnesota statutes. In particular,
just so we're clear, counsel, the court didn't make that analysis, though.
They did not.
Okay.
In particular, I'd bring the court's attention to the cases of State v. versus Hegstrom, 543 Northwest 2D 698. This was a DWI controlled substance case, and the court found there was probable cause with observed symptoms of intoxication, including constricted pupils and evidence of an inattentive driving. And State versus Prax, 686 Northwest 2D 45, this was also a controlled substance case where probable cause for the DWI existed with poor driving conduct, physical indicators of intoxication, including tremors, elevated pulse, and swaying. This case is the same for the probable cause. We had inattentive driving, excessive speed in this matter, plus observed independent indicators of intoxication, an odor of alcohol, and bloodshot, watery, and glassy eyes. The primary issue today is about the preliminary breath test, and I'm going to move on to that issue. Mr. Abrahamson has claimed that the administration of the preliminary breath test has violated his due process rights under Raleigh, and also that he did not consent to the test. I'm going to start with an analysis of Raleigh. To understand whether or not this was a due process violation, we need to understand how Raleigh has been applied in the Minnesota courts. Raleigh, as Judge Larkin mentioned, was about defendants who were told they had a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, and then they invoked it and were prosecuted for it. The United States Supreme Court did not find a violation because of the fact that they were informed they had a Fifth Amendment right to against self-incrimination. They found the violation because they were prosecuted for exercising that right. And that's the important distinction in this matter. It's not the statement alone. It's the prejudice or the entrapment that exists. The court in that case stated that to enforce the conviction would be to sanction the most indefensible sort of entrapment by the state. Convicting a citizen for exercising a privilege which the state told him was available to him. After that, the Minnesota Supreme Court analyzed Raleigh in the context of McDonald versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. In that case, one of the defendants, Moser, was read the implied consent advisory and informed that she would be subject to increased penalties if she refused to take a chemical test. However, as a first-time DWI defendant, she was not actually subject to those penalties. The court did not find a due process violation because of the misstatement alone. They found a due process violation because Moser testified that had she not been informed that she was subject to enhanced penalties, she would not have taken that breath test. And this was most recently reiterated in the Morehouse and Johnson cases. In those cases, the Minnesota Supreme Court said it wasn't the misstatement alone that makes a due process violation. There has to be prejudice. And another case, which was cited by Mr. Cheetah, was Witten versus State, where the state provided the defendant, Mr. Witten, with a restoration of his civil rights after he had finished his felony probation. And then he was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm. It wasn't the statement that he was restored to his rights that was a due process violation. It was prosecuting him for being a felon in possession when he was informed he had the right to have those firearms. Now, this is important to this case because Mr. Abrahamson has not alleged any prejudice. He said that he just submitted to the breath test after he was informed he was under arrest. He was not informed that he would be subject to increased penalties. He was not threatened with criminal sanctions for submitting to the breath test. In fact, he was told he was under arrest for driving while intoxicated. And at that point, he said, okay, I will take the breath test. The officer didn't force him to. He volunteered to take it. So under Raleigh,
Counsel, isn't there some coercion in the act of arrest?
Can you repeat that
question?
Isn't
there some coercion in the act of arrest?
So with the arrest, the trooper did go back and forth with Mr. Abrahamson whether or not he was required to take the horizontal gazeness apneas test and the preliminary breath test. The district court found this was not coercion. Specifically on the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, this has been found by Vondrashek and other cases that it is not a search. It is not entitled to Fourth Amendment protections. And consent is an exception to the warrant requirement for a search. And so any consent or coercion is irrelevant to that horizontal gaze nystagmus test. As to the preliminary breath test, going back to Judge Rodenberg's decision in Vondrashek, it's a search incident to arrest. And this was also reiterated before in State versus Bernard.
Right. If there had been probable cause to arrest, which you argue that there was.
Yes.
Then they could have invoked implied consent. Bernard says you can take search incident to arrest. There's an exception to the warrant requirement. If if the search incident to arrest applies to a breath test, which if you refuse results in a criminal penalty, then it surely applies to a PBT.
Correct. And the courts did find that it was a, the district court didn't make a finding about the search incident to arrest on the preliminary breath test, but State versus Bernard and Vondrashek and also Otto have found that the preliminary breath test would be a search incident to arrest. And in this case, it's very important that Mr. Abrahamson was informed he was under arrest, and that's when he submitted. So he was already in that arrest process, and he was informed he was under arrest for driving while intoxicated.
And the arrest at that point would have been based only on the field sobriety test plus the other observations of the officer, because there hadn't been a PBT yet.
Correct. It was based on the speeding, the odor of the alcohol coming from the vehicle, and Mr. Abrahamson was the sole driver, the sole occupant of the vehicle, and the bloodshot, watery, and glassy eyes that he had observed. If there are no additional questions on this issue, I'm going to talk about State versus Edgar, the Kansas case.
Counsel, I just want to work through this in my own mind for a minute. If there is enough for an officer, you mentioned speeding, odor of alcohol, as grounds for probable cause to go further, why don't officers, based on every time they stop somebody and smell alcohol and they've been speeding, put someone under arrest and then take the PBT as a search incident to arrest and not ask?
Well, it's an issue of driving while after drinking alcohol alone is not an offense. It's driving if you have a blood alcohol content greater than 0.08 or while you're impaired by that alcohol, that is an offense. And so officers do the field sobriety test to determine where whether the driver is impaired.
Okay, well then let's do that. Speeding, then drinking, and now you're done a field sobriety test. Why even ask about the PBT at that point if you've got enough for an arrest?
I think the officer was just trying to cover his bases. And
so confirm. Officers in the state of Minnesota on those facts can go ahead and arrest and take a PBT, force the PBT in a sense because it's a search incident to arrest.
The case law provides that it would be a search, but I am not aware of any of our officers in the state of Minnesota, and I have not had any of our officers that would force the PBT.
Okay, but it's not a consent issue anymore, right? If it's a search incident to arrest, they're...
Correct. I want to talk about the Kansas State versus Edgar case, which Mr. Abrahamson has alleged is similar to this case. This is a Kansas 2013 case. It was not cited in the district court and first raised at the appellate level. This is entirely different than the PBT statute that is at issue in Minnesota. Minnesota does not have an implied consent advisory or other advisory that has to be issued when they perform a preliminary breath test. Kansas, on the other hand, does. With that, any driver that the officer requests a preliminary breath test have to be informed that they have the right to refuse that, and refusal is a traffic infraction, otherwise a crime. This is more similar to our current implied consent advisory than the preliminary breath test. Our preliminary breath test, there is no rule that says that an officer must inform defendants that they have a right to refuse. And State versus Otto affirms that there is no obligation by officers to inform of any right to refuse standard field sobriety testing or preliminary breath tests. And it, unlike the Kansas law, it is not a crime to refuse that preliminary breath test. Under the Minnesota statutes, that refusal can be a basis to invoke the implied consent law, but it is not a crime in itself. And so these are very different. The wording of the preliminary breath test statutes are also different. In Kansas, it says may request. Minnesota statute says may require. Not request, require. Saying that the officers may force the defendant to submit to a preliminary breath test. I would note that State versus Edgar has never been cited in the Minnesota courts. And it makes sense because this is more applicable to our implied consent data master test than it is to any preliminary breath test.
Because there's a penalty that attaches.
Right, because there's no penalty and because of the fact of the right to refuse is a crime. Now, I only have a few minutes left. But I'd like to talk about Morehouse and Johnson in relation to McDonald for just a few minutes. Mr. Cheetah mentioned that McDonald is still good law. Based on the cases of Morehouse and Johnson, the McDonald test requires prejudice. The fact alone that there's a misstatement is not sufficient under McDonald, and that is reaffirmed in Morehouse and Johnson, which presented a three-part test for an implied consent advisory finding a due process violation. One, that the defendant submitted to a chemical test. Two, that they prejudicially relied upon the advisory. And three, that the advisory did not inform them of the legal consequences of refusal. So this is important because it goes back to the Raleigh test, which didn't find that a statement alone is a due process violation. It's when there's prejudice.
Why wasn't he prejudiced here?
He hasn't made any allegation of prejudice. And in the cases since Morehouse and Johnson, the courts have found that the defendant has a requirement to find that prejudice and allege it at the district court level. And if they don't allege that prejudice, the courts will not remand it.
So he didn't testify, you know, but for these statements about having to comply, I wouldn't have taken the PBT.
Right. What he said was, I don't know what I would have done. He didn't testify about the preliminary breath test. He said that he wouldn't have taken it before, but for the statement. What he said was he was under arrest, and so he decided to submit to the test. And that is in the transcript.
Well, let's ask about that now. Going back to what I just asked you, if now you're under arrest, is not taking the PBT resisting arrest?
No.
Well, okay, but we've already said that there's no criminal penalty for not taking the PBT.
Right.
But now you're under arrest, and you've been directed to take it.
He was not directed to take it after he was under arrest.
Okay, been directed before, but now you're under arrest.
Right.
Why isn't he under the belief that he must do that, or he's in further trouble?
If you listen to the squad video, that's Exhibit 3 in particular, you will hear the exchange between Mr. Abrahamson and the officer. And the officer says specifically, I am placing you under arrest for driving while intoxicated. Please turn around so I can handcuff you. And he says, okay, I will take the test. So he knew he wasn't being arrested because of the preliminary breath test or refusal to take it. He was being arrested for driving while impaired. I only have a few more seconds left. So, in closing, I just want to remind the court that based on the facts of this case, Mr. Abrahamson has not provided that he was prejudiced by any alleged misstatement about the preliminary breath test, and he voluntarily consented to take it, offering it up after he was told he was under arrest without any indication or suggestion by the officer to take it at that time. Because of that, he has not provided any due process violation, and we would ask that you affirm the district court judgments. Thank you.
Thank you. Appellant, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use that time.
I would argue that the state's citation to a couple of drug cases on the issue of probable cause are not compelling here. Those cases involved, according to the state, balance issues, inattentive driving, things like that. We didn't have that. In this case, it's an alcohol-related case, not a drug case. And if Raleigh truly says what the state says it holds, then we wouldn't have had McDonald for 30 years, right? We wouldn't have now Morehouse being the new law of the land. McDonald's still good law. Morehouse maybe adds a stronger prejudice component, right? There was some cases that says McDonald doesn't require any prejudice, right? And so you had people refusing, taking tests. It was all due process problems.
Well, counsel, presume we feel that there should be some evidence of prejudicial reliance in the record. What is it?
Well, with respect to the PBT, Mr. Abramson testified that he told me it was illegal, and therefore I took the PBT. That's what he said. That's his testimony. So to suggest that that didn't interfere with his meaningful choice regarding the PBT, that's right in the testimony, Your Honor. And Morehouse indicates, what is the language? The prejudice that interferes with the, quote, meaningful choice between submitting to and refusing a test. Trial court didn't find his testimony somehow not credible. He said, I took it because he told me it was illegal in addition to some other things, right? And so we can't really, that cat was out of the bag. The officer's duty was to put that cat back in the bag. He never did that at any point. I think the most he said was okay at one point. And there's a million different things that we could have interpreted by his language saying okay. But he had already said four or five times, yes, you do need to take this test. Defendant interpreted that to mean that it was illegal not to, as the court alluded to. And so clearly it affected his choice in with respect to the PBT. Later at the police station, now he testifies about that too. He doesn't know what he would have done had the advisory been read correctly. Why wouldn't he know? Because the advisory affected his choice. He agreed to take the test based on the advisory language. He didn't know what he would have done had it been read correctly. Again, that's interference with the meaningful choice.
Well, let's talk about that language. I mean, he did face legal repercussions, correct?
Correct.
If he didn't take the test, so that wasn't inaccurate?
No.
So you're talking about the presence of alcohol, or what language you were referencing?
Correct. That's incorrect language. The statute doesn't indicate that we get to inform people that we're going to take a test to determine the presence of alcohol, unless you're a commercial driver. So it didn't follow the legislature's law. And so that's a misstatement of law. He took the test. Where's the prejudicial reliance and the meaningful choice? Well, he said, I don't know what I would have done had it been read correctly. So to me, that means he took into account the way that the advisory was read to him, and it therefore interfered with his meaningful choice, right?
But I'm confused, because moments ago you said the problem with the advisory or the statements were that he was told that he had no choice. He had to take the PBT.
Right.
Okay, but now you're talking about the breath test. And you're saying that is also inaccurate because it used the words presence of alcohol instead of under the influence of alcohol.
Correct.
Okay,
and the prejudicial.
So my apologies. You're talking about two different pieces of evidence.
Right. And clearly the prejudicial reliance is much clearly out in the field with respect to the PBT than it is at the police station. But, I mean, if you have to testify, well, here's what I would have done. And, boy, if they'd read that correctly, I would have refused the test. I mean, I don't think that's going to be possible. He went as far as I think you honestly could in that situation. Calls for clear speculation. With regard to Edgar, the state's comments, and yes, it's true that in Kansas, I think it's a traffic infraction to refuse the PBT, at least at the time of Edgar, right? So Edgar hit all seven factors in Brooks, right? We basically hit 5.5 or 6. So there's not a different result here because of that if we look at the Brooks
fact. So just so I understand your McDonald argument regarding the breath test advisory, you're equating an erroneous statement that refusal to test is a crime with a statement that Minnesota law requires you to submit to a test to determine the presence of alcohol.
I'm only relying on that presence of alcohol language being a misstatement of the law.
Right. But essentially, if you're relying on McDonald, Morehouse, Johnson, you're saying that misstatement of the law should be treated similarly to the misstatement in those cases, which allegedly was, you'll be charged with a crime if you don't do this.
Correct. And lastly, I know we had an unpublished decision. It was Frank was the case where we said a PBT is not a full search. I did look at some of the case law in the nation. I don't think we see that come up. What's been happening since Birchfield is that the PBT is, in fact, a search, requires a clear exception to the search warrant requirement. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. The next matter on the calendar is Schneider versus Commissioner of Public Safety.